this. So, but I have Jan Urban, and I believe, yeah, I am pronouncing your last name right, correct?
Yes, it's Urban.
Okay. Well, sometimes it's you get confused over the W's, and I know it's...
Yeah, a lot of people try and add a W or a G or an E or something, but it's just Urban.
Okay, so I'm going to turn up the headphones just a bit here. So, and I'm going to let you, you know, describe yourself a little bit here, and I'm going to try to see if I can figure out some tape situation here for my finger. So, and just go ahead and describe yourself, and I'll be right back, all right?
All right. Well, I'm an author. I've written a couple of books. I co-authored my first book with Andrew Rutaji called Astrotheology and Shamanism, Christianity's Pagan Roots. My last book that I published in October of 2008 is called The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. I'm the curator of the John Allegro website. He was the famous Dead Sea Scrolls scholar who in 1970 came out with a book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross that argued that Christianity was based on a fertility mushroom cult. I also run the Gnostic Media website and the Gnostic Media podcast. I'm the host for the podcast there, as well as, well, probably what we're going to be discussing most tonight, I would think, is TriviumEducation.com, which is a... It's basically, it's a mental antivirus system.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. All right. A mental antivirus system. Okay. Well, then let's go ahead and get into the Trivium and the Quadrivium. And I mean, but you do have a whole lot more that you've done than just that. So I hope that during this interview we can go ahead into some of your other work as well.
Yeah, I mentioned my books there while you stepped away for a second. So, yeah, well, you know, basically what I should probably do is start out with a well-known quote by Edward Bernays. Are you familiar with who Edward Bernays was?
I am, but you might let our audience know.
Okay, well, Edward Bernays, he's basically the father of propaganda, or what we today call PR, public relations. And on page one of his 1928 book called Propaganda, he writes, quote, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is the logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized." And this is his claim to logic. It's his misapplication of logic, really. And then he continues, "Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society, at least for the elites, right? In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental process and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind." And then another very famous and infamous, I should say, individual, one of the wealthy elites, in his public opinion published in 1922, just to get, you know, and what I'm doing is just giving your audience a little bit of a foundation of the importance of what we're going to be going into and how this stuff works. So Walter Lippmann said, quote, "We learned to call this propaganda. A group of men who can prevent independent access to the event, can arrange the news to suit their purpose. In order to conduct a propaganda campaign, there must be some barrier between the public and the event. Access to the real environment must be limited, and therefore anyone can create a pseudo-environment he thinks wise or desirable." And so basically what they're doing is they're occulting information, and that's the real trick. It's not just occulting, but it's also spinning information and lying to people so that, you know, what the occult means, the word occult means hidden. That's all it really means. And to unoccult something, you become educated. In fact, if you look in the 1800s dictionary, it says education means to unoccult. So the way we unoccult things that are frightening or hidden from us is to study about them and learn about them. And I know many people will react with fear against the Kabbalah and against many of these type of things because they automatically think that it's dark or devil worship or what have you. But what people have to understand is that the only way that these things can be used against you is you by choosing to remain ignorant of them, and therefore you remain in the dark, and that's how they can be used against you. By you learning how these things work, then they can't be used against you. So as Thomas More said in the early 16th century, about probably the 1520s or 30s, he said, "For if you, the rulers, suffer your people to be ill-educated and their manners to be corrupted from their infancy, and then punish them for those crimes to which their first education disposed them, what else is to be concluded from this but that you first make thieves and outlaws and then punish them?" And that's from his book, Utopia. So that sort of gives us a foundation of propaganda and mind control through the media and all of these things so that we, you know, and so from here, basically we can go in and begin to understand how the quote-unquote noble lie is put over on the people.
Okay. So I've been listening to quite a bit on some of the interviews you were doing today on the trivium and the quadrivium, and those are terms that many people that I know that are in education that have not even heard of before. Correct?
That's absolutely correct. Basically, the trivium and quadrivium were removed from the public education starting around the 1850s and probably far up into the 1920s by the time they had gotten rid of most of it. It took a good generation or two for them to get it out of society. But basically, modern public relations or PR, law, the way the political system works, the way commercials and, you know, Madison Avenue public advertising works, none of that stuff would work today if people had these tools. And so let's get in for a minute and I'll explain what the trivium and quadrivium are. And the trivium, it does not come from the word trivia, which a lot of people confuse it to. It's Latin for three roads crossing or three roads meeting. And the trivium was originally developed by Aristotle in, well, about 500 BC or BCE. And the quadrivium was developed even earlier than that by Pythagoras. And so we're dealing with two very ancient systems. And today, even 2,500 years later, they're still considered the most advanced systems of teaching someone how to think for themselves, not what to think, but how to think, how to discover information for themselves, how to fact check things, how to spot if somebody's lying to them or telling the truth, and these sort of things. And the trivium is specifically in this order: grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And grammar answers the question of who, what, where, and when of a subject. And then logic answers the why of a subject. Rhetoric answers the how of a subject. And so these are really the foundations of critical thinking. Grammar you could consider input. Logic you could consider processing, just like your logic processor or your CPU and your computer. And then rhetoric is the output, or how you explain that information to somebody else or pass it on to others, whether it's in a book or, you know, verbal expression or what have you. And then the quadrivium is also specifically in this order: arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And arithmetic or mathematics is number in itself, which is a pure abstraction outside of space and time. And then geometry is number in space. Music or harmonic theory is number in time. And then astronomy is number in space and time. So basically, by understanding these things, it teaches us how to think, how to derive information via our five senses and anything coming in via the five senses. And it teaches us how to fact check things so that we know or we can spot if somebody's trying to put one over on us or if they're arguing the arbitrary without evidence and things like that, so that we can basically protect ourselves. Just like I said earlier, it's a mental antivirus system, so that we protect ourselves, and not only that, it prevents us or helps prevent us from passing false information on to others. It filters our own thoughts.
So when did you become aware of all this? I mean, you know, I mean, because you weren't probably taught this in school, right?
I was not taught this in school. In fact, it was brought to my attention around March or April of 2009 by a listener of my show. And from 2003 to 2005, I was writing my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, which deals with a lot of the ancient occult information and trying to unoccult it. And we were looking through all of this information regarding the sevens and seeing, you know, all of the different correlations where seven ties into, like, the seven chakras, the seven known planets at the time, the seven stars of the Pleiades, and all these different associations that the number seven has. And so the seven liberal arts kept coming up, and the trivium and quadrivium are what compose the seven liberal arts. The trivium is the first three, and the quadrivium is the second four. And if you mix any of them up out of the order that I mentioned earlier, it becomes a system of mind control that is used to control people. I mean, you'll have better thinking skills having a messed up version of the trivium than not having it at all. But just having it out of order, like many people put logic before grammar. And that's like trying to eat your food at a restaurant before you've ordered or told, you know, before you've read the menu or told the waiter what you wanted, right? It's getting everything out of order. So it has to always be presented in this specific order. And there's been a concerted effort to trivialize the trivium, to make it something that's unimportant when it's actually the foundation for the last 2,500 years of critical thinking, of ancient philosophy, such as the great books of the Western world and the Great Conversation. It is the foundation of this, and by not having the trivium and quadrivium, for that matter, people are not able to participate in the Great Conversation. And not only that, but they're likely to not even know that the Great Conversation and the great books of the Western world exist. So the Great Conversation is a conversation that's been continuing down to the present day since about the time of Socrates. And every generation of scholars and academics and thinkers adds to it. And so it's something that's people are completely unaware of. And then another word that has been mixed up and turned into its antithesis of what it really is the word liberal. And the word liberal means of or befitting the free. And it's come to mean today a tax and spend liberal, or somebody who wants to take your rights away or your guns away and all of these things, or somebody who is a communist or a socialist. These would actually be the antithesis of somebody who is a true freedom-supporting liberal. And the word liberal is where we get words like book. It's liberal is liber is Latin for book, and we store books in the liber libraries. And so the word book is synonymous with freedom. The word liberal is of or befitting the free, and it also means somebody who is educated in the classical seven liberal arts of the trivium and quadrivium. And then above the trivium and quadrivium, there is philosophy, there's theology and ethics and things like that as well. So it's an entire foundation of learning that's been sequestered from the masses so that they could be controlled. And the only way that the masses can be controlled by the trivium and quadrivium is by not learning it, like most of our forefathers were taught it as a matter of fact. The old schoolhouses taught on the trivium method, and that is really what created the great American industrial age.
You know, I'm watching numerous things that have been on the television over the years, and when you see these nonsensical arguments that come into place, that's where the trivium would really become helpful to people, is because it teaches them how to wade through these arguments that are based upon other factors, right?
Well, absolutely correct. And basically, and we can go into some of them now, actually, since we've given a little bit of a foundation. And people who may, you know, there may be people that want to follow along, and they can go to triviumeducation.com, and that's TRIVIUM education.com. And, you know, so on that page, if, you know, there's audio lectures there, there's videos on the website that they can read, there's a reading bookstore area up there where they can buy suggested reading. But keep in mind that all of the books out there today even have the trivium out of order. So it's important to understand that you have to, even though we have to study this stuff from people that had it out of order, just by knowing the proper order, you can correct the problem for your own learning. But the way that, for instance, understanding the trivium would help somebody watching the media and this sort of thing would be in the logical fallacies. And the logical fallacies are broken down into two categories, which are formal and informal. Excuse me. And formal fallacies are really the written word, okay? It's learning how to spot or to how to see sentence structure and how to understand if the sentence structure is built correctly for a statement to be true or false. And the informal fallacies are more spoken word fallacies, and we can go into some of the informal fallacies now. And one of the most common types of informal fallacies is an ad hominem attack, which means attacking the man. And let's say, if I'm presenting evidence of something, somebody says, oh, well, that guy, he's a Republican or a homosexual or whatever the case may be, and so, therefore, anything that I say would be incorrect rather than dealing with the information that I'm presenting. What they do is they just create false labels and attack your person rather than looking at the specific information. So any attacks on you have absolutely nothing to do with the evidence that you're presenting.
And one of the best ones that comes to mind is, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, and the word conspiracy was left without the word theorist added onto it until about the early 1990s. And that is an intentional effort to dissuade people from looking into things as well, just like trivia and trivium and the word liberal being spun as well. And so, you know, if you go walk into any courtroom, and I used to work down at the Orange County Superior Court buildings, and every single day conspiracy cases were being tried there. So anybody who thinks that conspiracies don't happen on a regular basis, it's absurd. But, you know, there's what we need to do is have a systematic method for deriving certainty with the information coming in via our five senses. So when somebody says something to us, rather than just dismissing it, we need to be able to figure out if what is being said is true or false. And the first thing that is done is to look at it from the logical fallacy standpoint. And then once we derive if a sentence or a statement has fallacies or what have you, then we still even have to verify it, because just know, you know, because sometimes there are people who don't know that they're using fallacies. They don't know what they are, and they use them mistakenly. So they're not intentionally lying. The word fallacy is Latin fallare, which means to lie. And so then there's other people who are trained in the logical fallacies and using them dishonestly. And they trace back, the group that uses them dishonestly traces back to Demosthenes, who died in 322 and is associated with skull and bones, 322. So the sophists are the ones who use these tricks against the masses in the media, in politics, in marketing, in public relations, and all of these things to manipulate and control everyone. So the logical fallacies are the fastest way to begin to spot how you're being lied to. Like if you walk into a used car dealership and the car salesman lies to you and he says, you know, if you buy this car over here, you're going to have the hottest girls and, you know, you're going to have the best time. And this car, you know, everything about your life is going to change or what have you. And what he's doing is he's giving you an appeal to emotion or an appeal to popularity. And it's like these beer commercials, you know, if you drink this beer, you're going to have the prettiest girl with the blue eyes, et cetera. These are logical fallacies that they use against people. They're intentional false tactics to manipulate people who don't understand logic and how it works. There are many others here. Let me just go back a second. Let's see. There is just under the appeal fallacies, and I should mention, you know what, one thing I really should mention is that the logical fallacies fall under three categories, which are presumption, ambiguity, and hold on, let me just pull up the last one here, relevance, presumption, and ambiguity. And then all of the other informal fallacies fall under those three categories. And I just mentioned the ad hominem, and you know, there's a lot of appeal to fallacies. There's appeal to fear, appeal to flattery. Your boss walks in and hi, Melody, that's a really pretty dress you have on today and a really, really nice haircut. You look like you're ready to make $1 million for us today. And this, you know, these types of tactics are flattery or appeal to pity, appeal to popularity, like I just mentioned, an appeal to ridicule. And an appeal to ridicule is a really interesting one because what somebody is saying when they appeal to ridicule, when you make a statement, they say, well, you know, that's absurd, ha, 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 ha. So what they're saying, in effect, is you're wrong because ha, 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 ha. And that's it. That's their evidence, ha, 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 ha. So it's a, obviously, without using an appeal to ridicule in return, it's an absurd argument. And there's appeal to spite, appeal to tradition, which, you know, we've always done things in our country this way or in our family this way. And even if it's wrong or it hurts us or whatever, we're just going to keep doing it this way. Begging the question is another really popular one that Christians especially love to use. And begging the question is also known as circular reasoning or circular logic. And it's basically when you present evidence of something, and let me just pull up the example here, is basically the premise in which the truth of a conclusion is claimed or the truth of the conclusion is assumed, either directly or indirectly. So in other words, what's happening here is I say God wrote the Bible. It says, you know, God wrote the Bible. And somebody says, well, how do you know that? And then I say, well, it says so right here in the Bible. Okay, so that's using the same thing that you got that from. Anybody can write a story that says that God or some spirit or deity wrote this book, right? But the fact is, if you go out into nature and you look at the things that God created versus the things that man made, you'll notice right away God created things like clouds, the sky, stars, planets, animals, plants, trees, things like that. Man created cars, roads, houses, walls, computers, books, things like that. So there are no contradictions in nature. Only man has contradictions. So when we go out into nature and we can see the obvious of the difference between things that God made and the things that man made, then we can recognize that indeed we are making a begging the question argument. And somebody might say, well, what about how the Bible predicts the future? Well, this is the post hoc fallacy. And the post hoc fallacy means that basically it's like saying a black cat crossed my path tonight, and tomorrow I tripped over the sidewalk and broke my toe, so therefore it's the black cat's fault. And what we're doing in this fallacy in regards to Christianity is you have people who are fervent, adamant believers in Christianity, and they go out and they do the things that the Bible says. They enact them in reality, and then other people turn around and say, oh, well, look, the Bible predicted that. So it's a bit of putting the cart before the horse. They're using the Bible as a guidebook on things to do to, you know, basically take control for Zionism, for political agendas, for what have you. So, like I said, it's putting the cart before the horse. Circumstantial ad hominem. You own a bookstore and you're putting in a law regarding books or something like that, or some new business thing that's going to affect your zone in a positive way, and somebody says, well, you know, it's a circumstantial ad hominem because you would benefit from those things. Well, first you would have to show that the person has a malicious intent by doing so and, you know, go from there. So you, even if you can identify the fallacies, you always have to make sure that you double check anyway, and that's part of critical thinking. Don't fall into the fallacist fallacy, which is basically because you hear somebody else using fallacies, you disregard everything that they say is false rather than double-checking anything.
Are we losing you, Jen?
No, I'm right here, and it's
Hello?
Pronounced Jan. I'm right here. I'm right here.
Internet connection problem.
I'm here.
Interesting.
I'm here.
Okay. Are you still there?
I'm here. Do you hear me? I'm here.
Are you there, Jen? Jan?
It's pronounced Jan. I'm here.
Okay. Do you think maybe I should try to call you back, or
can you hear me now, or is the signal coming back yet?
What?
Is the signal coming back yet?
You want me to call you back?
Is the signal coming back yet?
I'll go ahead and try to call you back here just a second. Okay, do we have you now, Jan?
Yeah, your gain is way too high.
Okay. Here we go again. How's that?
Far better.
Okay. All right. So we shall take up where we left off. That sometimes there's just things that crop up, and it doesn't matter how many backup plans you have. So we were talking about what now? Do you know your cutoff point here before we started having problems with Skype?
I don't remember. Where was I? Do you remember?
You were giving examples on the different types of...
All right. Well, anyway, I'll just pick up on another one. I think I was on begging the question or something like that. But anyway, we'll. I had mentioned the post hoc fallacy, I believe, as well, saying that you can predict the future, that the Bible predicts the future when... It's more that that you have fanatic believers who act out things that are in the Bible, and then other people will say, "Oh, well, see, the Bible predicted this." It's the post hoc fallacy. It's putting the cart before the horse. Let's see. There's confusing cause and effect, which is A and B regularly occur together. Therefore, A is the cause of B. Again, it's sort of like the black cat crossed your path fallacy. And then the gambler's fallacy is another really common and popular one. You see people walk into casinos all the time, especially in Vegas, and they'll see somebody get up from a slot machine who's been sitting at a slot machine for an hour or two, and then they'll walk over and they'll play that slot machine thinking that because that other person sat there and possibly didn't win, that your chances are now increased. Well, with the gambler's fallacy, what you have to realize is that if you go to a slot machine and you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of winning on each pull, it doesn't matter if somebody sat there for an hour, a week, or a month pulling that lever. Every single pull is you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of winning. So Vegas and casinos really make their living off of the gambler's fallacy. Guilt by association is a common one. If you know somebody who did something wrong, then you're automatically wrong because or guilty because you knew that person, or you know, a brother or a sibling, etc. That's also similar to poisoning the well, which poisoning the well is basically when somebody, let's say if I publish a book and one of my books is proved wrong, and then years later I publish another book and on a completely different subject, and somebody says, oh, well, he was wrong in this book, so everything else that he writes about is wrong. That's poisoning the well. You have to look at each instance on a point-by-point basis. You can't give a blanket dismissal because, you know, something in a different time on a different topic was found to be an error. And another common and popular fallacy is the red herring. And the red herring is, this is a really another politician's favorite. It's, if you ask a politician a pointed question, they'll usually divert the topic onto a completely unrelated subject and then have a little discussion about that and pretend that they answered your question. So it's just a diversion tactic. And it was created in the days of training hunting dogs to go after the fox, and when the hound was ready, was considered about ready as a trained dog, what they would do is they would drag a fish across the fox's trail to see if they could divert the hound away from the fox and on to the smell of the fish. And another common one is slippery slope. If you legalize marijuana tomorrow, people will be shooting heroin in the streets, that type of fallacy. Another common one is the straw man fallacy, and this is a very popular, very common fallacy. And it's basically person A has position X, person B presents position Y, which is a distorted version of position X. And then person B attacks position Y, and then he pretends that therefore position X was also debunked or dismissed. And so, you know, people will, they'll set up a fault. You know, it can be somebody who, let's say somebody writes a book on a topic and some hater that doesn't like that person's research will go on Wikipedia or on Google and say, well, see, I don't see any evidence for the claims that are made in that book. Well, if the person doesn't read the book and doesn't look at the actual citations that that author presented, and then they go to an entirely different source and look for those citations, well, that's a straw man argument. This is really commonly done one of the most common ones that I see it in is astrotheology, which was presented in my film, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, and then later on it came out in Zeitgeist Part 1. And people would attack that. They would do Wikipedia and Google searches and say, oh, well, it's all come from Madame Blavatsky or Gerald Macy and the Theosophists, when in actuality, if they had actually read these people's books or gone in and into the university libraries and through the academic journals, you would see documentation of these things going back to the first century at least. And so that's basically a rundown of the most common types of fallacies that are used against people. And fallacies are really, you know, I recommend people go out and start studying them right away. And a lot of people will begin to be able to apply them just from my explaining them. And what happens is you want to learn the names of all of the fallacies and exactly what they are, because the more you study them, the more you understand them. And what happens is you go from implicit, that funny feeling that you get when somebody lies to you, which that funny feeling or that intuition should only be a trigger for you to recognize that something else is going on and for you to kick on your mental antivirus and figure out exactly how you were lied to. So your intuition is that implicit knowledge. But the explicit knowledge is when you can name all of the fallacies, all of the lies that are used against you, so that you can name when the car salesman or the lawyer or the politician or whatever tries to pull one over on you, you know exactly what type of lie they're using against you. And, you know, before I forget, I should mention people will also be interested in another project of mine. It's called popupfallacies.com, P-O-P-U-P, fallacies, F-A-L-L-A-C-I-E-S.com. And that's a little project that we started recently, and people can actually see Obama's recent speech on the death of Osama bin Laden, where Obama, in a 9 or almost 10 minute speech, has over 85 fallacies, and which means that he's got a what we call it as a lie per minute rating, or LPM, and Obama's lie per minute rating is 9.5 lies per minute.
So it just goes to show you that, you know, that this is kind of important to be able to know this kind of information so that you can kind of start being able to pick out between the mechanisms used to get us off in other directions that isn't keeping us on topic and following through with the logic, correct?
Correct. And, you know, what people do is they put their logic before their grammar. See, your grammar is your who, what, where, and when. That should give you the information, the details. And there's two different types of grammar. There's special grammar and general grammar. Special grammar is dealing with words within a specified language like English or Russian or Latin, French, etc., whereas general grammar relates to words to the objective world around you in language, such as car, boat, wall, bird, tree, etc., and applies to all subjects as a first set of building blocks to an integrated or fully mindful objective knowledge or body of knowledge. So it's in actuality, you can look at grammar as research, as doing your diligent study, gathering all of that who, what, where, when information, right? And then logic, and grammar is also, I should point out that grammar is also known as knowledge, okay? And logic is known as understanding, and logic answers the why of a subject. And you can't put why before who, what, where, when. How can you know why something works? How can you know why a building stands, or why a sentence is put together the way it is, or why a word is put together with these certain letters, or much of anything, how anything is put together in reality or on a page, if you don't know who, what, where, when first? So you gather your knowledge before you can have understanding. Knowledge always precedes understanding. And what happens is, in our society, the major problem that people have due to not having the trivium for the last 150 years in our education is they try and put their conclusions or their logic first. They try and put their why first before they look at the information. So if you can't answer who, what, where, when, and why, or who, what, where, and when first, you don't try to answer why. So that should tell you that you always need to go back and gather more data until you have all of the information to form a complete body of knowledge. Then you remove all of the contradictions from that, and that is logic. Logic answers why, and logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. And then once you have a body of knowledge, once you understand it by removing the contradictions, then you can express that knowledge and understanding to others through proper rhetoric, which is how. So you answer how. If somebody comes up to you and says, how does that work? Well, you say, well, who, what, where, when, why, and how. You know, you're expressing it as that how. So it all has to go in order. And if somebody takes it all out of order, the whole system falls apart. And this is why some groups teach the trivium out of order as well. It serves, I think, a nefarious agenda, because if a group even teaches the trivium but out of order, you still can't properly think. You're still not going to know that you need to gather that data. And it might seem like common sense, but when you study the trivium and how it works as a functioning system and constantly repeats in itself grammar, logic, rhetoric, input processing output, how can you have, again, like I said earlier, output before processing or input? What would you possibly output? And what would you process before you input? Who, what, where, when? That's your input. Why is your your logic, your processing, and output is your how, your rhetoric. So this is the rules of thinking, of common sense. And that's really the biggest problem in our society today. Today is politicians, even when people say, you know, like you mentioned, conspiracy theorist earlier, right? What is somebody, typically a conspiracy, somebody who uses the word conspiracy theorist is somebody who refuses to check the who, what, where, and when before they make a decision on the evidence. They say, well, that person is a conspiracy theorist. I don't need to look at anything that they have to say. Well, if I come up to you and say, well, who, what, where, and when did that person, what was that person talking about? And you go, well, I don't know. He was a conspiracy theorist. I just dismissed him as a wacko. Well, that means you're the liar. You're the one using fallacious logic, lies, to dismiss information rather than to do your due diligence and study it first. And see, even if the information is false, by studying it first, then you know exactly how it's false. And you can express that as wisdom to others on how it's false. Or you filter it out and you don't pass it on at all, such as your computer's virus system does. If it gets a virus in, it says, oh, hey, what's this? Oh, that's bad information. I'm not going to send that out. I'm going to delete it. And then you get rid of it. Okay, you don't, you know, and as somebody who gets a virus and passes it on, it's like when your Outlook gets a virus in it, you know, through the email, and suddenly everybody in your email, in your address book, gets an email sent out, which everyone's either received one or at one time from somebody out there. This is basically what it means to not use the trivium when you process any type of information, and the New Age movement is very guilty of this type of thing as well. But filter that information first. Make sure that you're verifying it before you pass it on. And it might take you a few minutes of time to verify it, but in the long term, the amount of time that you would have otherwise wasted having false beliefs, as well as all of the time of everyone else out there who you pass that information on to, you're wasting all of their time with false information. So it's just like, you know, if you send out a virus to somebody on from your computer, from your email, now you've wasted not only your time having to take it down to the computer store before you had your system properly checked, but now everybody else who got that, if their system wasn't properly protected, then they all take up their time to get it fixed as well.
Well, so where would you like to go with this further? I mean, or do you want to get in a little bit into your other information, Jan?
Well, it's, I don't know, how long were you planning the interview? Are we about done here?
No, this is a two-hour interview.
Oh, it is. Okay, I wasn't aware of that. I thought it was an hour.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, let's see. where would you like to begin? I've done a lot of work in a lot of different areas, especially my main background is ethnobotany and ethnomycology. I'm currently working on a couple of different book projects. I already mentioned two of them that I did in the past, but I'm presently working on a large two-volume interview project with many of the world's leading researchers and experts in psychedelic studies. I've done over 50 interviews for that book project. I'm also currently doing a book project that is investigating the founder of the field of ethnomycology, a guy by the name of Gordon Wass, and he's the quote-unquote discoverer of magic mushrooms, which was published in Life magazine in the 1950s. And I've been investigating his background and discovering some rather interesting details that have been omitted for the last 60 years in our history books.
Well, you know, I would like to go there, and you were doing some stuff with I'm trying to think of the other Allegro, John Allegro.
Yes.
Now, that if you want to, now is this before or after the fact of why you got into your interest in this particular area, and what did bring you into getting interested in this magic mushroom?
Well, interestingly, I got into studying the history of magic mushrooms and religion, which is known as ethnomycology, close to 20 years ago. Originally, I worked with Jack Herer with the California Hemp Initiative. Jack Herer was the author of The Emperor Wears No Clothes. He died in April of last year after suffering a heart attack in 2009. But he's the one that really spearheaded the hemp movement, as well as the national medical marijuana movement. And I worked with him to help pass Proposition 215 back in the 90s, and worked to, you know, starting in late 2002, early 2003, working on the California Hemp Initiative. And, you know, today there's about 50 countries that are using industrial hemp again, which weren't in the 90s. And in fact, all cars coming out of Germany today have to have, I think, 10% or something like that hemp. And Jack was always researching another field of study, and he and I spent a lot of time together, and he was researching this guy by the name of John Allegro, who had written a book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and I republished with Allegro's family in 2009 the 40th anniversary edition, excuse me, of Allegro's book. And it had been out of print for about 25 years. And anyway, Jack Herrod originally turned me on to this field of research, and he told me that, I remember back in the early 90s, we were giving lectures at the University of Riverside in California, and we were in between lectures, and we were sitting down having lunch or something, and he says to me, did you know that Judeo-Christianity was based on a fertility mushroom cult? And I looked at him like he was completely crazy. And he starts going into this long description of all of this stuff relating to mushrooms and religion and everything. And back then, this was long before the internet, before you could go on ABE books or something like that and do a search for used books and come up with rare finds instantly. So eventually he gave me a photographed copy of his copy of John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And I was probably about 23 at the time, so this was a long time ago. And I sat there and I read that book, and I read it again and I read it again. I just thought it was the most mind-blowing thing I had ever come across. And a lot of people had dismissed Allegro's work and said that he was crazy, or said that all of his research was false and that he made up all of the citations in his book. And in the 80s, Jack Herrod, he had gone through many of Allegro's citations, and he found them all to be correct. And based on a lot of my own research over the preceding years, I found his work to be largely correct as well, with a few minor errors, which culminated into my second book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, where I go through all of the academic attacks against Allegro, and show how they were all, in fact, made up. And, in fact, the main guy who launched the attacks against John Allegro was this man, Gordon Wasson, the founder of the field of ethnomycology. Now, an unknown background of Gordon Wasson, well, everybody knows who's involved in this field or this area of study knows that he was a banker. And what they often don't know is that he was vice president of public relations for J.P. Morgan Bank. And he was trained by a close friend of his that we discussed earlier, a man by the name of Edward Bernays. And Wasson was also a chairman for the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the man who authored the Stock Exchange Act. He hung out with the guy who was the head of Operation Paperclip. He was close friends with Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, the head of the CIA and U.S. State Department. His direct boss was Henry P. Davison at J.P. Morgan Bank, who was one of the guys at Jekyll Island who created the current Federal Reserve scandal. And, and I could also say Wasson was also about he was 1 to 2 degrees separation from 10 or more people involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Okay. So, you, I mean, some of these names that I got into studying a little bit of these kind of things, and there was a whole group that seemed to come out of the San Francisco area that was getting into various aspects of various other forms, not necessarily from the religious aspect, but from other means. You know what I'm talking about?
No, like what?
Okay, well, you know, around Stanford and Eslon and that they were doing...
Oh, sure. Well, you know, and those guys were being funded through, like, the Tavistock Institute, which was being funded by, the British intelligence, U.S. intelligence, Israeli intelligence, to find ways to minimize the impact from, like, shell shock and stuff like this. This is, certainly Eslon or... Assailant, however you pronounce it, was heavily and probably still is heavily involved in this stuff. You know, it's interesting because the field of psychedelics heavily overlaps in many areas with military and mind control projects. And just like most tools, psychedelics, you know, it's like a knife. You can use a knife to kill someone, or you can use a knife to cut your food, right?
Right.
It depends on how you use it. It's just a tool, and you can use them for spiritual purposes, or when somebody breaks free from the control paradigm, they're also easily reprogrammed into another control paradigm. For instance, a lot of people will take psychedelics and they'll break free of the major dogmatic religions and then fall right into the New Age movement, which is largely based on theosophy and Fabian socialism and these sort of things to trick people into joining socialist movements and giving up their autonomy and,
right.
You know, think positive, don't act, don't do anything, let's sit on a pillow and let somebody else handle it. Meanwhile, they bulldoze us over and destroy the world from our lack of action.
Right, but let me do one thing right here. This is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and I've got Jan Urban with me, and he's speaking about the trivium and quadrivium, and then we've moved on to some other subjects that he's dealing with that have to do with magic mushroom and in its tie-in maybe with the religious cult and possibly other mind control factors.
Well, yes, and you know, and as far as not just into religious cults, but the mushroom and psychedelics in general have been shown to be the foundation of many or most of the world's religions, including Judeo-Christianity. In fact, I was the first to publish an ancient primary Christian text, the Epistle to the Renegade Bishops, that specifically discusses the holy mushroom. We also find the mushroom discussed in the Book of Zohar and the Jewish Kabbalah. We find the mushroom discussed in the Muslim Mishkat as manna when this guy asked Muhammad, what is manna? And Muhammad says that manna is a type of mushroom sent by God so that men can see. And the debate is whether or not this mushroom is a psychedelic mushroom or a truffle, because the word sight there can be interpreted as physical or spiritual sight. So, you know, there is that we have not only ancient primary texts to back up these claims today, but we also have literally thousands of religious iconographic images, like originally John Allegro published the Plancoro fresco from a chapel in France from the 13th century that depicts Adam and Eve on either side of an Amanita muscaria mushroom. And this, when he published his book in 1970, it was thought to be the only one at the time. But we've since found hundreds and, thousands, really, of mushrooms and other churches and cathedrals stretching from Russia down into Greece, into Turkey, and all the way across Europe into England. So it was a very widespread practice, and you know, it's hard to limit it to a heretical cult or something as part of Christianity. And
but what it rings true of, from my understanding, then, is that a lot of your native a lot of your religious sects might have had some sort of a ritualistic mechanism used with these type of...
Oh, absolutely. I think that the religions are based on the exoteric and the esoteric. There was the inner and the outer teachings. The inner teachings were reserved for the priests and the elite, and the outer were the exoteric were the ones that were fed to the masses and taught as literal history. If we think of John Allegro argued that Jesus himself was an anthropomorphism of the mushroom, and in fact we did find a painting in a Christian cathedral or Christian chapel in France, about 20 minutes from the Plain Crow Chapel in Montferrand du Perigord, France, that in fact shows Jesus as the mushroom. And we even had a mycologist who was able to identify the specific type of psychedelic mushroom that Jesus was depicted as there, writing on the back of St. Christopher. And for those interested in that image, they can see that. They can either look it up on Amazon. It's on the front cover of my book, The Holy Mushroom, or they can see that on my website at GnosticMedia.com. And, of course, that's GnosticMedia.com, where they can see that there. Go ahead.
Because you have, like, your native, some of them will utilize the peyote.
Use
ayahuasca. There's numbers different...
And what people try and do is they say, well, these are these primitive brown cultures, the Mexicans and the Asian cultures and the black cultures that use these things and the Indian cultures. But, you know, us, the white European and Judean cultures, they didn't use any of these things. And that's completely contrary to the evidence. That's, again, going back to the trivium. That's trying to put your logical conclusion before you've checked your who, what, where, and when.
Okay, now what about your Eastern religions? Did they have something of similar?
Oh, well, absolutely. And, in fact, there's estimated to be at least 108 plants dedicated to Shiva alone that are psychoactive. Soma has been debated for decades whether or not it was cannabis or a psychedelic mushroom or opium or ephedra or some other type of psychoactive drug. Many either settle between cannabis or a mushroom. And you have bhang or bhang in India that's made from cannabis and still practiced and used regularly today. And, Buddhism came out of Hinduism, and it's been argued many times by many researchers that Buddhism has ties to psychedelics as well, though they vehemently deny it, just like the Christians do, whereas Hindus a lot more open about it. But there's still an underlying trace of shamanism running through a lot of the Asian cultures as well, that these practices can still be seen, that probably came over from Asia into the Americas, into the Native American religions. And then you go down into Africa, and they use the Tabernanthe Iboga, which is a very powerful psychedelic plant that's also used for curing heroin and opium addiction today. And it's the most effective treatment for heavy drug addiction out there. And psychedelics are actually completely non-addictive. And, this drug ibogaine that's derived from the Tabernanthe Iboga plant actually has the ability to block the person's opiate addiction. So the next day after the person comes down from this grand psychedelic voyage, the drug has blocked their ability for future addiction. And not only that, just like in Alcoholics Anonymous, during the experience, it forces a life review. So you're forced to look at all the pain you cause others when you abuse these substances and steal and do all of the stuff that a lot of people that get addicted to these things do. So, it's like the full Alcoholics Anonymous treatment program in a couple of sessions, and they do recommend follow-up sessions later on, but you can pretty much be fully cured of opium or heroin addiction in a 24-hour period.
But you don't hear about that practice among the Western civilization with these particular types of drugs, though.
Well, it's actually Ibogaine is legal to treat drug addiction in just about every Western country except the United States.
Okay. So, so when we get back to Allegro and some of your work with these the ties to the Christian, what really drew you into going into that particular area with it? What was so fascinating about it to you?
Just the process of discovery and
okay.
You know, turning stones over and looking and digging and saying, you know, that's not right. That doesn't make sense. And like I said, logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. And so when you're researching something, when you come across contradictions, that should tell you that either somebody is lying or you need to do more research and figure out where the contradiction is coming from. So I just kept digging and digging and digging until I had established a body of knowledge and was able to realize that there was a lot more to this than people, you know, it's just like the trivium. The trivium was suppressed. This, where religions came from, you know, and if people think about it globally, you know, just like the Native Americans you mentioned earlier using peyote and many other things, not just peyote, that's just the most recognized by the whites that they use, I think. You think of, you know, like you mentioned ayahuasca earlier, the Mazatec using mushrooms and morning glories in Mexico, all of these different cultures around the world, all of them all over the place, or just about all of them, are using some form of mind-altering substance. And, you know, so when we look back across history and all of these different cultures, then it doesn't seem like such a far-fetched idea when we try and look at Judeo-Christianity as having come from these same origins. So if we put away our predisposed literal interpretation of what our preacher or someone told us to think of the Bible and the stories, and we put that aside and we look at the evidence first and let the evidence tell us, and hey, you know, all of these cultures did, then we realize that it becomes much more of a crazy story to argue that Christianity and Judaism were not affected by these shamanic practices as all of these other cultures.
Well, do you find that my thought just went out of my mind. So when it comes down to these different uses and tying them in with these religious sects, but doesn't that, when you start connecting that with the Judeo-Christian aspect, isn't that kind of tough on one's
beliefs?
Well, it isn't not beliefs so much as their occupation.
How they're occupied? Well, I mean, well, sure, it would put pastors out to pasture, right?
Or, you know, like, yeah, how did that affect John Allegro?
Well, when he went public with the story in 1970, this guy, Gordon Wasson, again, working as the PR vice president for J.P. Morgan Bank, he immediately launched a major campaign against Allegro, totally denouncing Allegro and saying that all of Allegro's conclusions were false. And so what they did was they immediately spread all of this false information about Allegro all over the media. And Allegro was, he was an Oxford scholar. He was studying for his doctorate in Asiatic languages or Oriental languages, which includes the Middle East, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And he was sent as one of the top representatives for England in Semitic languages into Jordan to go study the Dead Sea Scrolls with the rest of the Dead Sea Scrolls team. So, you know, he was no dummy. He was one of their top guys. And then basically in the 1950s, he came out in a couple of radio interviews that he did and said that the evidence in the Dead Sea Scrolls challenged the many things challenged the Orthodox interpretation of Christianity. And for this, he was attacked by his own teammates working on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And Allegro, he was really the one who even brought any public attention to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Without Allegro, we may not even know about them today, and they may not have even yet have been released, because Allegro put out all of the first books on the Dead Sea Scrolls, all of the first translations, and he also fought against the rest of his team to release their sections of the Dead Sea Scrolls to other academics and the public for further study. And until the Huntington Library near in San Marino near Pasadena, California, until they released their photographs in 90 or 91, for 40, 50 years, there was really nothing else out there on the scrolls except for what came from Allegro. And so, you know, we owe him a lot for even bringing our attention to them. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that rather than allowing the evidence to speak for them for itself, these people like Wasson had an agenda to go out and destroy Allegro's reputation and set themselves up selling, you know, their own very expensive books for, you know, $400 a copy or more back in the 1950s and 60s, which was like equivalent to like $1,800 a copy today. These people had their own agenda that they were pushing over rather than allowing the evidence to speak for itself.
Well, you know, I'm finding that over and over and over again in throughout the different disciplines, and that anybody that steps outside of the box goes through this kind of treatment. And so they really don't make it easy for anybody that wants to think for themselves.
Right. Well, and that's why it's so important to get the trivium back out to people so that they can spot this type of false rhetoric and, you know, counter it effectively. And so it's, you know, it's really important that people study the trivium and the logical fallacies and teach it to their children, especially because it's really the key to our freedom issue and how all of this stuff is pulled over our eyes. If you have a systematic method of critical thinking to derive certainty, all of these tricks out there that they're using against us become pretty useless.
Well, you know, this is going to come out of left field a little bit here, but what I did an interview recently with John Taylor Gatto, and I know you've done several.
And yes.
When I brought up the trivium and quadrivium to him, he didn't seem to be as thinking that it was as important today.
He may have had it out of order at the time, but interesting that you brought it up, because my business partner Richard Andrew Grove just had John Taylor Gatto at his house over 4th of July weekend and recorded a DVD series called A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto that'll be released soon, where they go into depth on the trivium and its effectiveness in all of this. And I know for a fact that if that was what John Taylor Gatto thought 3 weeks ago, he no longer thinks it now.
And it would have been probably right around in that time period and not...
Right. And I had interviewed him the week before that as well. And those DVDs will be released in the next few weeks, and people will be able to get that from Richard Grove's TragedyAndHope.com website. And, you know, there's one other interview that's up on my... the channel that someone sent me that they recorded a lecture that Gatto gave recently that's up there as well. But Gatto and Grove talk extensively on the trivium. And, you know, just because somebody is unaware of its effectiveness or has it out of order themselves and doesn't understand exactly how it works doesn't mean that the rest of us should dismiss it. It just means that the point should be made more poignant to the other person.
Well, at the time I didn't realize that, you know, that would have been, so maybe if I get to hear this interview, then it might make that more of a clearer picture in my mind as to why and what for the timing and the order that was taking place when he made that statement. And, but like I said, I asked a number of educators and they did not know what it was, but he did. But it's like you said, you know, maybe sometimes it takes discussion to get people to come around to, you know, looking at it with a new, you know, with fresh eyes. So, so when it comes down to doing, do you see yourself having a lot more work to do in this area of research that you're doing with these I can't even say the term.
Entheogens?
Say that. Spell that.
Entheogens. And entheogen. En means within. Theo is God, and gen is to generate. So they're substances that generate the God within.
Okay, because that's a totally new word to me.
Well, it's actually been around since the 1970s. The word psychedelic has been largely dismissed. And, in fact, psychedelic, which means mind manifesting or manifesting the mind, is actually an improper formation of the Greek. It should properly be psychodelic. And it's because of the connotations of the 60s and, you know, that whole fiasco, almost the entire research community has completely moved away from using that word.
Okay. Now, and I wish I wish I'd had a little bit more time before I looked. I was primarily thinking we were going to go the trivium quadrivium, and then when I got kind of drawn into your other work, I wish I'd have had a little bit more time to pull up some of the past people that I had looked into that had done studies on some of these herbs and plants that are they in. I'm going to have to write that word down, or I'm going to.
Entheogens. Yeah, you know, and I've, like I said earlier, I've had about 50 of the world's leading researchers on my show, and we're putting together about a 1,000-page, 2-volume set of all of these interviews that's going to, you know, cover all the latest cutting-edge research in the entire field.
So you're kind of out there on the cutting edge of this type of work then. I mean, you have
to. Oh, yeah. You know, and not only that, but I'm, you know, like I said, I was the first one to publish an ancient primary Christian document that specifically discusses the holy mushroom. And I'm also the first one to dig into the founder of the field's background, Gordon Wasson's background, revealing his associations with the CIA, the Council on Foreign Relations, and all of these other groups. So, you know, and he's largely been put up on a pedestal in worship for the last 50 or 60 years, and he's got a less than shiny reputation, to say the least.
Is he still alive?
No, he died in 86, 85, 86, thereabout.
Okay, and, I mean, because you did bring up some of the things where he was, and you were saying that he was somewhat trying to discredit John Allegro, and...
Right, and, you know, I went through line by line and all of the attacks that he used against Allegro, and we went through all of Allegro's citations, went through the university archives and dug up the original citations that Allegro was using and fact-checked every single one of them, and we were able to prove that every single attack that they made against Allegro, especially Wasson, every single one of the attacks was false.
And I find that it's kind of interesting that... My understanding was that particular mushroom was more of a, had a lot of toxicity to it. And
what mushroom? Well, you know, it does have something called ibotenic acid in it, which is converted into muscimol. And there is a lot of misinformation, disinformation out there on all psychedelics in general. But, you know, you do have to be careful with any of them. You don't want to just go out and pick them, but... You know, we do have the stories in the Bible like Jonah and the whale, of this diving down into hell experience, into the belly of the whale, and then going up into the glories of heaven, right? So we're not talking about all love and light and shiny experience here. These people were going through purgatory to get to heaven. And so we need to realize that the dark experiences, the ones where you learn about yourself and learn things that you need to clean up in your life, and the positive experiences, they go together. You don't just ignore one and pretend that it doesn't exist. It's just like the new age sort of glossing over of shamanism today. They bring up this sort of rosy version of even South American shamanism and ayahuasca shamanism, when an unbiased study of South American shamanism reveals that dark shamanism and sorcery is heavily embedded into the entire practice, and that light shamanism and dark shamanism are really only a fine line apart. To, you know, it's just the light shaman knows the arts of the dark shaman and vice versa, and it's just one choosing to apply it in a more hurtful way. But dark shamanism, which is basically blood violence and tobacco, and ritualistic murder and revenge killings over against sorcery, is standard practice in many of the traditional shamanic cultures in South America and Asia, and for that matter in North America. And this stuff has been completely glossed over in New Age interpretations of shamanism. It's really, you know, it's really a colonialist shamanism that's being portrayed in the New Age movement. It's not a traditional shamanism. So really what's happening is, again, these cultures are being suppressed for what they really are, for our own interpretations.
So how does the religious community deal with this? I mean, do you get any good feedback from any of them?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I get probably every week I get emails from former Christians that have come across my work and were completely mind blown over it. But as far as negative feedback, I might get one or two emails in a year, and it's always by somebody who puts their beliefs and their fears and their logic before their grammar and their research and their fact-checking the material. And, you know, it's somebody that has an agenda or a belief to protect, and they, you know, they grew up with this or that, and their mommy told them this and that, and their grandma and grandpa, and they just don't want to believe that all of those people could be wrong, you know, because, well, a million people can't be wrong, but in fact, usually a million people are wrong, and it's very easy to mislead a million people.
Well, all I can say is that I can just imagine what it's like to try to read these. When you start to research this sort of thing, are you reading these books and then looking? What is your process, I guess?
You go through the books, you follow through the citations when they come up, and you try and track down those citations, and you just follow them through to the end. You know, that way that you have your knowledge base, and then you work back the other direction with all of the data that you've collected, and you can fact check everything and remove the contradictions between what people said or claimed, like they did against Allegro. Allegro had a finite amount of citations in the back of his book. He had 150 pages of citations, but, you know, it's a finite amount that you're dealing with. So there's only so much checking that you could do, and I only focused on specific areas of his citations when I went through, because I was able to find other academics who've, you know, like Professor Carl Ruck from the University of Boston has since come out and given full support for Allegro's work. Professor John Rush up at Sierra College in Northern California has gone public for Allegro's work, as has Garrett Kaiser, who's a well-known mycologist in Europe, has just recently gone in full public support of Allegro. And, you know, and over the last 5 or 6 years, I've heard from many dozens of academics who believed all along that Allegro was right, but nobody had really done their homework and gone through Allegro's footnotes and had verified if the attacks against him were correct. And, you know, in 38 years until I had written my book, The Holy Mushroom, I was really the first one to go through line by line and check each one of the claims against him, his original, what he said, his citations, track down the citations, and compare what he claimed against the original citations.
If I can recall what you were saying when I was listening to the one interview, that he had a tremendous amount of footnotes on his work, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, just the Sacred Mushroom, the Cross book alone, like I just said, had 150 pages of endnotes.
Right. So, again, that sounds like it can keep you busy for.
Oh, yeah. And they're very, very academic. But, you know, you can go through. And, you know, there were claims out there for years, even by leaders in my field of study, that said that Allegro contributed absolutely nothing of importance and that he made up all of his citations and research. And then you get in there and you actually start fact-checking this stuff, and you see that it wasn't Allegro that was making up stuff. It's the people that are attacking his work who are making stuff up. You know, if Allegro is correct, it threatened a lot of other people's jobs and careers, not to mention churches. And, you know, Gordon Wasson, back to this guy, he was, I forgot to mention earlier, he was the account manager to the Vatican for J.P. Morgan Bank. So he was working directly with the Pope, one-on-one with the Pope, in fact. And so he did have an agenda to smear Allegra's work against Christianity for J.P. Morgan Bank alone, not to mention if Allegra was correct, his own research would have been proven incorrect.
I did an interview just recently with Michael Cremo, and he was going through various aspects of belief systems or disciplines that were, you know, with the archaeology and having to question the origins of man, or where that, you know, that there's a lot more information out there that's been accepted in the academic community. So obviously this sort of thing does also happen with the religious community, particularly when you're looking at this kind of aspect that seems to be overlooked. And that's that. It seems to be that there's a similar situation taking place, as they like to pick through the information that fits their scenario. And
all right. Well, sure. And, you know, and what they're doing is they're not doing their proper grammar, their proper who, what, where, and when first. They put their logical conclusions, their beliefs, before they put their data gathering. And instead of allowing the data to tell the story, they tell the story and then try and force the data around their story.
Right. And this is everywhere. It's just amazing.
It really is. It's an extremely rampant problem in our day and age. And it can be traced back exactly to the trivium being taken out of order or not being taught at all.
So is there an avenue that you really want to go that you haven't really explored yet in this area?
Well, to be honest, I'm actually getting really exhausted right now. I'm about ready to call it a night because I've had a very long day, and for that matter, a month.
Okay.
And I don't know, I'm just... I've had a lot on my mind and a lot of work, and I'm about to fall asleep on you.
Okay. All right. Well, I will go ahead and play some music here before I come up with my interview with Dave Hodges after this. So we can go ahead and end it here. And I really appreciate you coming on and doing the interview with me, Jan. So
you're welcome, Melody, and have a great evening.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.